ball player will make with his contract. But once his playing days are over, where is the annuity? Dead as a doornail. The really smart people in professional athletics are the team owners and the agents. These agents are an especially crafty group. They don't have much specific talent themselves. They don't run, kick, block, or score goals. They don't sing or dance. Yet they last and last. So what if you are one in a million on the football talent scale? You were a high school All-American, a first-team college All-American, and the first running back drafted in the pros this year. But you blew out a knee. Your agent, on the other hand, has a growing stable of your kind. He grows his business like people grow apple trees. Once you are in his orchard, you keep producing for him. When you can no longer produce apples or hammer nails, they remove your dead or dying trunk from the field. A replacement apple tree is inserted like the interchangeable parts of a machine. The frugal and productive Points. The Points are a retired couple who live in a fine four-bedroom home in one of Austin's nicest neighborhoods. They have a net worth in the high seven figures. They are a frugal couple, very careful about how they spend their money. As Mrs. Point says, "My husband and I grew up during the Depression, so we both are careful with our money." Although they currently live in a home worth $800,000, it has paid for itself over the years through appreciation. To the balance sheet affluent, careful means selecting a home and neighborhood very carefully. It may also mean paying more for a home initially and having higher property taxes. Make the correct selection and you may do even better than having the home pay for itself in real dollar terms. Mrs. Point expressed her attitude about this. "I believe in living in the best section of the city. Location, location, location. I will do without fine cars, but insist on having the best home possible." Certainly the Points could have it both ways. They could purchase expensive automobiles and clothing and still remain in the millionaire league. But that's not their style. Mrs. Point graciously outlined the philosophy that she and her husband have always maintained. They believe that it's very important to be price-sensitive with respect to products that lose all or most of their initial value as soon as they are purchased. In terms of dollar value, these items are highly perishable. For example, clothes. If you purchase an expensive suit or dress today, how much is it worth at tomorrow's garage sale? Perhaps 5 or 10% or less of the original purchase price. Mrs. Point never wants to spend big dollars on clothes. They depreciate in value too rapidly. They put a hole in one's net worth. But she always wants to look well-dressed. Here is her solution. "Oh, yes, I wear couture clothes that I buy at the Junior League shop. Most of them have been donated by one of the wealthiest families in the U.S. Yves Saint Laurent, Armani, Valentino, Oscar de la Renta, Gucci, Dior. I love clothes. In fact, you could say I collect them. I even have Balenciaga." If some of these clothing items don't fit perfectly, she and Mr. Point do what about 4 in 10 millionaires do to solve this problem. They have the clothes altered instead of buying new. The money Mrs. Point saves as a result of her thrift shopping orientation is allocated to items whose prices are highly durable, that actually appreciate in value. "I am mindful of the fact we live in a time of medical miracles. I invest in stocks related to medicine." Mrs. Point believes that stock purchases will enhance the couple's net worth, while paying retail for expensive clothing has the opposite effect. It's not that the Points are miserly people. Clearly they are not. They just want to always be financially independent. They also have other people in mind when they operate under a philosophy of being highly productive. They plan for their 6 children to have substantial inheritances. Let's review Mrs. Point's style. She believes in buying a home that will appreciate in value, but she doesn't believe in paying retail for clothing and other items that retain little of their original price. Better to invest in medical stocks that have longevity. There is another reason why Mrs. Point invests in medical stocks. Being very health conscious, she reads about health issues and attends many seminars and programs about health and medicine. She is very productive in terms of killing 2 birds with 1 stone. She enhances both her physical and her economic well-being by reading about and studying up on health medicines and new drugs and patents. Most food items are perishable. Does this mean that Mrs. Point skimps on food in order to enhance her economic wealth? I am a big believer in eating healthy food and exercising, but I am very careful with food purchases. I clip and organize coupons, do my own cooking, etc. I'm sure that Mrs. Point seems like a confusing mixture to many people. She wears expensive clothing, but doesn't spend much for automobiles. She uses discount coupons, but lives in an expensive home situated in a top neighborhood. People might think that she and Mr. Point are just hanging on financially, but appearances can be misleading. We have land and mining operations and oil leases. We do not tell our friends about our holdings because many of those we associate with do not have as much as we do. Mrs. Point is like many millionaires when it comes to purchasing furniture and household accessories. She spends money on furniture that has lasting qualities, furniture that is highly perishable, that essentially dissolves when hot coffee is spilled on it, has never entered her home. We buy quality items and make them last. We buy 18th century antique furniture. People like Mrs. Point are wealthy because they allocate a disproportionate share of their furniture dollars to categories that have lasting value. Even if you pay $10,000 for an antique table and chairs, this furniture has two functions. You can sit on the chair and eat off the table, and you are maintaining an investment. This is a major reason why most decamillionaires regularly attend antique fairs. So many of them are self-made. Their parents were not rich. Their parents and grandparents were likely to be what I call preservers and collectors, a trait that is nurtured in well-functioning, loving families that extend over several generations. Today's millionaire has a home that contains grandma's prized chest, great-grandma's manual Singer sewing machine, grandpa's pre-1864 Model 70 Winchester rifle, and Uncle Bill's coin collection. Some people believe hand-me-downs are junk. To them, new is always better. It defines success. Old indicates economic failure and reversals. But not millionaires like Mrs. Point. She is very confident and proud about who she is and how she accumulated considerable wealth. No one from Madison Avenue will ever tell her how to think. She has her own ideas about the value of new versus old, or real wood versus wood dust. That's why she and Mr. Point are wealthy. Recycling. Tassels versus Nikes. Are the affluent in America the ultimate consumers of goods, buying today and discarding tomorrow? Perhaps the thought of recycling, or specifically resoling shoes, is abhorrent to them. The findings from my national survey of millionaires contradict that hypothesis. 70% of the millionaires surveyed have their shoes resold. This number is something of an underestimate because about 20% are retired millionaires who normally give up wearing their dress uniform, which includes footwear that tends to be resold. These shoes are often referred to as dress shoes, or executive footwear, normally worn by men, including the 4 in 5 millionaire respondents who are males. These shoes have brand names like Alden, Allen Edmonds, and Johnson Murphy, and are normally sold in men's specialty stores and upscale department stores. These are specialty goods that are not likely to be found in the closets of every household in America. Shoes of this type are favorites among senior executives of public corporations, owners of top private corporations, and top-producing physicians, attorneys, investment bankers, and stockbrokers. Why do they pay $200, $300, or more for a pair of shoes? It's all a matter of perception and preference. Most people, especially men, make purchase decisions about shoes according to initial price or first cost. When they need dress shoes, they buy a pair of black shoes at the lowest possible price. These people are price or first cost sensitive, and they are one of the major reasons that so many discount shoe stores exist today. The other segment of the market for dress shoes, many of whom are multimillionaires, is relatively first cost or initial price insensitive. They are less concerned with variations in the price of shoes than they are about the quality of dress shoes. These quality-sensitive people define quality in terms of life cycle cost. My Alden tassel loafers are more than 10 years old, and they've been resoled, full soles replaced, twice. Plus, they never go out of style. They are by far the most comfortable shoes I have ever owned. At the end of many 12-hour workdays, my feet have never given me discomfort when I was wearing my Aldens. They are built to last, support, and give comfort to one's physical foundation, so they are not inexpensive relative to other types of shoes offered on the market. If you are a business executive or a professor of business, you want to wear the uniform. Cross trainers don't cut it, nor do cheaply constructed dress shoes. A survey respondent cited his experiences with so-called cheap dress shoes. Cheap shoes wear you, you don't wear them. Allow me to expand on the point about life cycle cost. In the 10 years that I have owned my Aldens, I've had them on my feet approximately 1,600 days. I initially paid $100 for the shoes, and they've been resold twice at about $50 a turn. So my out-of-pocket cost was $200. Add the $20 I put out for a good pair of shoe trees, and the total cost was $220. The shoe trees are critically important in enhancing the life cycle of quality shoes. Divide 1,600 wearings into $220, and that computes to just under 14 cents per wearing. In sharp contrast, let me advise you how much it costs for my teenaged son's shoes. He goes through, that is, wears out or styles out, about 6 pairs of Nikes or Adidases per year. Mostly he wears them out from just walking around a very large college campus. But he also does some running and sandlot touch football in them. Brad's mom estimates that he gets between 80 and 100 wears per pair of shoes. These shoes cost between $65 and $85 per pair. Even with the best case of 100 wears, the life cycle cost of these shoes is 65 cents per wear. Given these numbers, I have to ask who pays more for the shoes they wear each day. Is it the millionaire executive in his $300 calfskin loafers, or the college student in his $85 supercross trainers? Appearances can be very deceiving, and so can the first cost or purchase price. For many products, life cycle cost is a much more relevant criterion to use when shopping. You can refinish wood, but not sawdust. Look inside the home of a millionaire and you may be surprised at what you see. You may expect a highly decorated home filled with the latest styles in furniture and accessories. So much for yet another myth about the affluent. The interior design and furniture purchasing habits of millionaires are not what you see in movies or on television. They don't change their furniture like Hollywood movie stars change husbands and wives. Most millionaires live in single-family homes of traditional design. These homes are well-built colonials, including English Tudors. The interiors are filled with traditional furniture, with early American designs most prevalent. When it comes to modern furniture, millionaires are not major consumers. They prefer high-quality, traditional furniture, which never goes out of style. Their furniture has another notable characteristic. It's usually made of wood, not sawdust glued together, or thin layers of quality wood on particle board. Millionaires prefer furniture made of solid wood, or in some cases, quality veneers placed upon high-grade solid hardwoods. To get a look at the actual style, not necessarily the brands, of the furniture these people own, visit a local furniture store. Look in the yellow pages under the heading of furniture and note the stores that sell high-quality 18th century and other traditional furnishings. Look for keywords like Baker Williamsburg, Council Craftsman, and Henkel Harris. These aren't the only brands you're likely to see inside the homes of wealthy people, but they give you a good start. Millionaires not only tend to have traditional or old-style furniture in their homes, they are also significantly more likely than the non-millionaire population to own furniture that is actually old, or antiques. Ask the dealers of genuine antiques about the characteristics of their main target market, and they will tell you that the largest portion is composed of affluent people with traditional taste who are more sensitive to the quality of furniture than variations in price. There are several sources for the traditional furniture owned by millionaires. First, they purchase high-quality reproductions that are made of real wood, most from dealers. Some have the furniture custom-made. Second, millionaires have a propensity to purchase high-grade antique furniture of traditional style. Third, they acquire some of their furniture from intergenerational gifts and hand-me-downs. Independent of the source, the furniture tends to be of the same caliber. It is traditional in design, well constructed, with real wood. In the eyes of the millionaire, this type of furniture is in the high-quality category. The quality doesn't just refer to construction. It has something to do with how long a piece will last. The best furniture, even with minimal care, will last a century or more, and the issue of physical longevity is important. But how long will traditional furniture remain in style, and thus in high demand, among the affluent population? No one can be completely certain, but past trends often predict the future. High-quality furniture will probably appreciate in value. How many consumer goods purchased today will appreciate in value tomorrow? That automobile you paid $30,000 for 4 years ago. That $500 or $800 suit you purchased yesterday. In sharp contrast, I have seen 10- and 20-year-old Henkel Harris and Baker Furniture, just to name two brands, sell for more than twice the original purchase price. By definition, millionaires tend to be accumulators, a trait they inherited from parents who were collectors. Their parents and grandparents held on to things that had value. So the majority of millionaires have a family legacy of collecting, saving, and preserving. Waste not, want not is a theme acted out by first-generation millionaires today. Their ancestors passed on possessions that had lasting sentimental as well as monetary value. They intuitively knew the value of collecting and preserving things that would appreciate in value. Their prediction about the appreciation of certain objects was not their only motive. Even today, their sons and daughters who are millionaires tend to purchase with others in mind. They deliberately purchase furniture today they can pass on to the younger generation tomorrow. This, in essence, is their definition of quality furniture. It will outlive a person's normal adult lifespan, will never lose its appeal, and will probably appreciate in value. Think of the selection process for furniture through the eyes and minds of millionaires. They see the real benefit of furnishing their homes with the furniture I have described. They may pay 2 or 3 times more for a quality chest or dresser than for a piece of molded and glued sawdust imitation. If the lower-priced chest is a veneer on sawdust, it may never last for a half-generation. Leave a bit of water or coffee on top, and the veneer might separate from the sawdust. Then you can't saw sawdust. You can't even sand sawdust. You can refinish high-quality furniture over and over again. Why would wealthy people have their furniture refinished? They don't think of furniture as a consumption item or a non-durable. They don't buy new furniture as soon as the old furniture has a scratch on it. Nearly one-half, 48% of the millionaires who responded to my latest national survey report having furniture refinished or reupholstered instead of buying new. Mrs. Clarice Rector, a multimillionaire, once told me that she refinishes and reupholsters everything in the house because it's just so much more convenient than searching, shopping for new furniture hour after hour, looking at high-priced nothings. Mrs. Rector has developed a list of great refinishers as well as several reupholsterers. I call, they send me swatches, they pick up. No malls, no hassles. Her favorite reupholsterers carry a wide variety of fabrics. According to Mrs. Rector, fabric selection is much easier than selecting new furniture. She has had the same family-owned shop reupholster her favorite couch 5 times in 30 years. Along these lines, a recent Wall Street Journal news article by James R. Haggerty and Robert Berner asked, "On the couch, ever wonder why furniture shopping can be such a pain?" The article documents the difficulty people have finding furniture to purchase. Even after countless hours of searching, the buyer may have to wait weeks, even months, for delivery. There are so many styles and colors of furniture today that it's very confusing, even to a seasoned buyer. The Wall Street Journal mentioned one company that offered 1.7 billion possible combinations of sofas and upholstered chairs. Given the variety of fabrics and styles, is it any wonder that many millionaires refinish and reupholster, as opposed to searching through so many combinations of furniture? Looking for clues. There are certain actions that reveal a lot about our households and whether they are economically productive. When I began studying the traits of affluent households, more than 200 actions and habits were proposed. These were developed in part in my focus groups and personal interviews with millionaires. Eventually, 13 actions were included in the questionnaire used for this national survey of millionaires. Why only 13 actions? because response patterns to these actions could predict the responses to others. In turn, four major patterns emerged from the survey data. Take pattern one, extending the life cycle. About one half of the millionaires, 48%, indicated that they reupholstered or refinished furniture to reduce the cost and enhance the productivity of operating a household. These same respondents also tended to respond that they have their shoes resoled or repaired and clothes mended or altered. Now consider pattern two, reducing the monthly burdens. Overall, the responses to the three actions under this heading are independent of those items included as extending the life cycle. In other words, responses to the switching long-distance telephone company's action are not significantly associated with responses to the having furniture reupholstered item. In order to understand the millionaires better, one must analyze several distinct response patterns. There are four factors in all. The two mentioned, pattern three, planning purchases, and pattern four, patronizing discount institutions. I have determined that of all the actions, there are two that best represent the millionaire's approach to reducing the cost and enhancing the productivity of operating a household. The two actions that are key to understanding millionaires are switching long-distance telephone companies and having furniture reupholstered or refinished instead of buying new. I looked at two samples of millionaires. The first group contained only respondents from economically productive households who switch long-distance telephone companies and have furniture reupholstered or refinished. The other sample contains respondents from non-productive households who didn't do either of these actions. How do millionaires in Group 1, who operate economically productive households, EPMs, differ from the non-economically productive millionaires, NEPMs? The two groups have very different styles when it comes to accumulating wealth. EPMs are wealthy for several reasons. Of course, they operate productive households, but they are also much more deliberate in their approach to purchasing a home, and they spend more time studying and planning their investments. What about those in the NEPM category? How can they be millionaires and not run an efficient household? They earn so much income that it's difficult not to become wealthy. In order to fully appreciate the contrasting styles of these two groups, case studies are in order. Mr. Oakes versus Mr. O'Toole, the pro formas. Mr. Oakes has a net worth of approximately $7.5 million, but he's not in the EPM group. He and other members of his household never took the two key actions, that is, switching telephone companies and reupholstering or refinishing furniture. Mr. O'Toole is worth about $5 million, and he indicates taking almost all these actions. It's a matter of strategy and styles. Mr. Oakes has an annual realized income of $829,000. He works very long hours as an attorney. He is focused, and his energy is devoted to his career. As long as he is tops in his field, he feels that wealth will show up accordingly. Mr. Oakes and his wife believe that most, if not all of the actions taken by millionaires to reduce the cost and or enhance the productivity of operating a household, take time and energy away from a very high-paying career. He is of the strong opinion that his single best strategy for becoming wealthy is to focus his superior intellect on the practice of law. Mr. O'Toole is very different in his orientation. He is an entrepreneur in the recycling scrap metal business. His annual realized income is $544,000. And his net worth is estimated to be about $5.2 million. He has a lower level of net worth than Mr. Oakes, in large part because of income differences. Mr. O'Toole would have considerably less wealth if he did not have an economically productive household. In fact, since his marriage more than 25 years ago, he and his wife have always operated their household productively. They had to do so, or they would not have been able to build their recycling business. Mr. Oakes and his wife are different kinds of householders. Mr. Oakes graduated from a top college near the top of his class in both undergraduate and law school. He was immediately hired by a top law firm. Before long, he was a partner of the firm. 60, 70, even 80-hour work weeks are not uncommon for Mr. Oakes. He works hard and plays hard. He has the pro forma answer when quizzed about actions that might be taken to reduce his household's operating costs. Penny-wise, pound foolish. He maintains that household operating costs are in the penny category. The pound category involves focusing all his intellectual energy on helping a client win a $100 million settlement. If his client wins, Mr. Oak's income will be more than $1 million next year. That's why he has little interest in reading about the variations in value of stoves and washing machines in Consumer Reports. The Oaks just buy the most expensive household appliances, theoretically the best. Here are some other interesting differences between Mr. Oaks, the NEPM, and Mr. O'Toole, the EPM. They were asked about why they are successful, and they share certain common success factors, as do most millionaires. Both claim it has something to do with being well-disciplined, working hard, getting along with people, and being competitive. But Mr. Oaks, the high-income producing attorney, also attributes his success to having a high IQ, superior intellect, attending a top-rated college, graduating near or at the top of my class. Mr. O'Toole has his own set of group-specific explanations for success. Investing in my own business, having a supportive spouse, willing to take financial risk given the right return. And there is one more success factor that is very important to Mr. O'Toole. Living below my means. More than one half, 53%, of those millionaires in the EPM category rate this factor as either very important or important. Only about 1 in 3 of the NEPMs rate this factor in a similar fashion. Mr. O'Toole and his fellow EPMs have a different lifestyle than Mr. Oaks and the NEPMs. The EPMs are significantly more likely to attend religious services, read the Bible, shop at Walmart and Kmart, eat at McDonald's and or Burger King, be involved in do-it-yourself carpentry projects, shop via the Internet, mow their own lawns, garden, attend antique fairs or sales, consult with an investment advisor. Mr. Oaks and the NEPMs are more prone to attend major league sporting events, attend fundraising balls. Part of the EPM lifestyle is integrating shopping behavior and investing behavior. EPMs shop aggressively for homes, and they perceive their home as part of their investment portfolio. Many NEPMs don't see it that way. About 81% of the EPMs, but only 52% of the NEPMs, indicate taking weeks, even months, to shop around for the very best deal overall. This is not to suggest that either group made a bad decision in financial terms when buying their current homes. The median year of their home purchase was 1988, and since that time, on average, the value of the homes owned by NEPMs more than doubled. The O'Toole group did even better. Their homes nearly tripled in value. EPMs strongly believe that it is economically productive to shop for homes aggressively. Both bought fine homes in high-ranking established neighborhoods, and both were very wise to do so. But Mr. Oaks and the NEPMs took very little time shopping for the very best deal. Essentially, they bought a fine home, but they paid for quality. The O'Toole EPMs shopped and shopped. They exhibited great patience. They bought fine homes, but at discounts generated by aggressive price negotiating and by looking for foreclosures and other real estate that had to be sold in a hurry. Both the Oaks and the O'Toole types were winners in the residential real estate market. The O'Tooles did better, but they spent much more time and energy in the process. Mr. Oaks, the high-income producing attorney, hates to shop, and he has no time to look for the buy of the decade. Under these circumstances, people like Mr. Oaks buy trophy homes in trophy neighborhoods. They generally deal with the cream of the crop of real estate agents. They tell the agent, "Find me a trophy home within a week or month." In the long run, their home appreciated, and it will continue to do so. Thus, a rule from the Oaks types can be appreciated. When faced with lack of time, it's better to buy a quality home at a high price than a non-quality home at a reduced price. Analyze the net worth and income characteristics of the NEPM and EPM types, and you'll see that they are quite similar. The Oaks NEPMs have an average annual realized income of $830,000 versus the O'Toole EPMs with $544,000. The Oaks have an average net worth of $7,550,000 versus the O'Tooles, who have accumulated on average $5,200,000. This translates into dollars of net worth accumulated for each dollar of income realized at $9.56 for the O'Tooles and $9.10 for the Oaks. Contrast $9.56 and $9.10 as productivity measures. The EPMs at $9.56 are more productive than the NEPMs at $9.10, but not by that much. It's only about a 5% difference. In essence, both groups are productive in generating high incomes and corresponding high levels of net worth. Each adopted a wealth-building strategy that suited their respective abilities and interests well. What if Mr. Oakes, the high-paid attorney, and Mr. O'Toole, the scrap metal dealer, changed styles? Both would probably have a severe reduction in both their incomes and net worths. Never try to adopt an economic orientation that is incongruent with your abilities and aptitudes. About 80% of both groups suggested that their current vocation allows full use of their aptitudes and abilities, and so do both of their respective philosophies about enhancing the productivity of their households. The home. Question: how can you be wealthy? You live in a $1.4 million home. That's a lot of risk. Answer: but I only paid about 40% of $1.4 million when I bought it. Risk is buying a home in a neighborhood where nothing appreciates. We've learned something about how millionaires' lifestyles result in economically productive homes, but what about the homes themselves? What are their homes and neighborhoods like, and how do they buy and sell them? This section explores the answers to these questions provided by my survey and explodes many more myths about America's affluent. The following section describes the millionaires' homes in their own words. Welcome to the neighborhood. I am the prototypical millionaire. Call me Brian Abel. I live in one of America's balance sheet affluent neighborhoods, neighborhoods containing high concentrations of millionaires. Nearly 80% of my neighbors are millionaires. In sharp contrast, only about 5% of the approximately 100 million households in America are in the millionaire category. Thus, as residents of such neighborhoods, we are fully 16 times more likely to be wealthy than the average for the nation. I purchased my home about 12 years ago, and my family has lived there ever since. The approximate purchase price was just under $560,000. According to conservative estimates, it would sell today for just under $1.4 million. I increased my wealth in nominal terms by approximately $850,000, or about $70,000 per year. Most of us have the same old-fashioned orientation. We buy homes and tend to hold on to them for long periods of time. In contrast, about 20% of American households move each year. We are different kinds of people. More than half of us, 53%, have not moved even once during the past 10 years. About 1 in 4 of us, 24%, moved just once in the past 10 years. About 80% of these moves were local in origin. As a group, we have a very strong tendency to stay put. One reason why we seldom move is that many of us are self-employed professionals or owners and managers of our own businesses. Moving away from our clients, patients, customers, or key suppliers would have a significant negative influence on the productivity of our enterprises. Just the process of preparing to move can be extremely disruptive, especially in long-distance moves. As BAs, Mrs. Abel and I have noticed one change in the mobility patterns of our group. An increasing number are upgrading, hoping to capitalize on a rising market in their respective geographic areas. They are selling homes they paid $500,000 for 10 years ago for $1.4 million today, and then reinvesting locally in more expensive homes. They anticipate that these upgrades will appreciate even more rapidly than did their previous homes. Many of the upgraders have considerable knowledge of the real estate markets in their areas. Some are even upgrading with intra-neighborhood moves. This type of move is more common in the newer cities of the South, Southwest, and West. In most other areas, especially in the Midwest and Northeast, the buy-and-hold orientation is alive and well. Most BA neighborhoods were established decades ago. On a national basis, the median year of construction of homes owned by millionaires was 1958. In fact, fully two-thirds of us live in homes that were originally built before 1973. In sharp contrast, only about 1 in 20 of us live in homes that were constructed in the last 5 years. Most of us enjoy living in well-established neighborhoods. There is nothing flashy or even modern about the style of houses in these neighborhoods. Our homes give us away. For the most part, they are conservative in style, like our lifestyles. Our homes range from well-constructed and designed traditional colonials to English Tudors. Even though most of us are multimillionaires, we typically don't live in large mansions. Only about 2 in 100, 1.7%, live in homes with 8 or more bedrooms. More than one half, 52% of us, live in homes that have 4 or fewer bedrooms. Typical among us are married couples with 2 or 3 children. So who needs 8 or more bathrooms? Only 2.3% of BAs live in homes that have 8 or more bathrooms. Nearly one half of our homes, 46.6%, have 3 bathrooms or less. Changes in the neighborhood. Mr. and Mrs. Abel, the prototypical BA household, have noticed some changes in their neighborhood recently. The BAs are selling, but they are not always being replaced by others with the same orientation. Allow me to introduce the prototypical income statement affluent, IA couple, Mr. I. Steve Adams and his wife. Throughout the BA neighborhoods of America today, the IAs are purchasing homes. Stever is a 35-year-old stockbroker who earned over $500,000 last year. He and his wife were euphoric about earning so much money, and they purchased a home for $1.4 million. The original owner paid less than $400,000 for the home 15 years ago. Stever paid for his purchase with a jumbo $1.2 million mortgage. Only 1 in 20 of his neighbors has a mortgage balance of $1 million or more. It's common for people in Stever's age and occupational group to be purchasing million-dollar homes with jumbo mortgages. In fact, according to my data, high-income-producing people in their 30s and early 40s make up a disproportionate share of the jumbo mortgage market. Stever is not a millionaire. He doesn't even come close to the crude definition of BA, that is, having a minimum net worth that is 10 times one's annual realized income. Stever will find that even today, most of his neighbors are BAs, who are not dependent on sales commissions or even a booming stock market to sustain them. Never borrow long-term with the prospects of short-term income. Stever can only hope that his sales commission income and client base will not turn away from him. If the stock market declines, or if his income is cut in half, Stever will be bankrupt. And who will buy his home at a large discount? Probably a BA couple. They will be the only ones with a pile of dollars set aside who love to look for nests that fall from trees. These people don't allow the euphoria of upswings in income to intoxicate them into making unwise and ill-financed purchases. It isn't only stockbrokers who are leveraging today's sales commissions. The generic category called high-performance sales professionals in their 30s and early 40s are getting into BA neighborhoods late in the upswing of home prices. The homes they are buying have already doubled, even tripled in value in the past 10 or 12 years. They are also late because they had to wait until the economy was already in an upswing. They get paid commissions only after they make a sale, and sales volume increases as the economy expands. But real estate prices are directly attached to changes in the economy. When the economy and corresponding stock market is booming, so are the prices of homes in BA neighborhoods. Sales professionals are rarely in a financial position to do it at any other time. In good times, they are high in income. But even then, they are low in wealth because they spend, 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 and borrow, borrow, borrow. Most BAs are very different. They buy homes only after they have accumulated wealth and only after they have a well-established, predictable cash flow. Assume for a moment that you're a long-time resident of a BA neighborhood. Recall the last time when the economy was going nowhere and the stock market was at Dullsville. Who bought houses in your neighborhood then? Owner and operator of funeral homes? Scrap metal dealer? Owner and operator of parking lots? Heart surgeon? senior partner with major law firm, owner and operator of waste management business, senior partner of accounting firm. These BAs bought a home when they felt they were fully qualified to do so, one that will likely be affordable for them. Finding a lovely home. Have you ever spent time shopping around for a home? Many of the respondents to my interviews have told me that shopping for a new home can be frustrating. It's as if all the homes on the market at any one time have significant drawbacks. Many have been on the market for months. Where are all the resales that are truly lovely homes? Homes that are lovely sell very quickly in most instances. I use the term lovely to define those that are in excellent condition, nicely decorated, well situated on a quality lot, and located in a fine neighborhood with good public schools. These homes often sell within days of first being listed with a real estate broker, and some are sold even before the listing is public. In some instances, lovely homes are sold without the help of the third party, a professional real estate broker. When the wisest potential buyers seek help from top-rated real estate agents, they advise the agent, 1. We are not in a hurry to buy. We can wait, but we are serious buyers. 2. When a lovely home is listed, we want to be told as soon as possible. But remember our parameters. It must be in top-notch condition and in the right location. Most millionaires are in this category. The majority surveyed indicated that they never even tried to purchase a home in a short period of time. It's not that they procrastinate when the opportunity to purchase an ideal home arises. They are just satisfied to wait for the right lovely home to appear. The millionaires never place themselves in a position where they are forced to accept a substandard home. This is in sharp contrast to many employees who must relocate to a new town and have 2 days or less to find a home, or who accept new jobs that require relocation. Is it any wonder that frequent geographic mobility is a negative factor in accumulating wealth? Again, more than one half of the millionaires in America have not moved in 10 or more years. More than 1 in 5 are living in the same home they purchased at least 25 years ago. Let's say you are looking for a new home and your search turns up 2 choices. One is 25 years old, occupied by the original owner. The other home for sale in the same area has been occupied by 8 different owners. Odds are that, like most millionaires, you would pick the first home as your first choice. 8 owners leave 8 different traces of their existence on and in the home. Wise buyers prefer the one-owner, low-mileage model. How does one go about finding the low-mileage home? One method is to hire a top real estate agent. But there are many situations where ownership of a lovely home is transferred with literally no advertising, no real estate agent, and no parade of prospective buyers walking all over the home. For example, when my father died, we knew my mother would have to sell our family home eventually. Everything about the house fit the definition of lovely. Well-built, well-designed, well-maintained, in a good location, with only 2 owners in 45 years. Mom waited until 6 or 7 months of her designated moving day, and then let several neighbors know the house was for sale. She said no to the real estate agent who called and asked for the listing at 7% commission. As word spread, my mother made it clear to neighbors she wasn't in a hurry to sell. She exuded confidence that the home would go in an instant, further enhancing the image of the house. Ultimately, there were several hungry buyers, and she wound up selling with less than $1,000 in miscellaneous costs. The lesson is that, like many wealthy sellers, you can use the local grapevine to find buyers without having to pay an agent's commission. My friend Billy Gilmore has found another successful technique. When he was searching for a lovely home, he approached a local developer with many condominium units to sell. He reasoned that the developer might have an inventory of potential buyers who were unwilling to sign up without first selling their current homes. The developer was able to refer Billy to a number of those, and one suited his family needs perfectly. So everybody won in that situation. I have encountered situations where very aggressive prospective buyers have canvassed neighborhoods. They merely knocked on the doors of homes they were interested in purchasing. These homes had no visible for sale signs or other indications. Buyers just targeted them because they are appealing. Yes, even these cold calls can work. But I estimate that normally it would take a long time to find that lovely home owned by a long-time resident who is just beginning to feel the need to sell. Proactive searching. It seems logical to the man on the street that people who have accumulated less wealth would be more careful, more deliberate when purchasing a home, and those with considerable wealth would not have to be as concerned. If they make a bad home-related decision, it's not going to bankrupt them. In fact, millionaires are much more deliberate in their home-buying process than non-millionaires. Even among the ranks of millionaires, however, there is an interesting correlation. Who is more likely to search for a bargain home that was part of a foreclosure, divorce settlement, or estate sale? Those with net worths in the 1 million to 2 million group, or decamillionaires? More than 1 in 3, 36% of the decamillionaires indicate bargain shopping for a home that was part of a foreclosure, divorce settlement, or estate sales. Fewer than 1 in 5, 18% of millionaires in the $1 million to $2 million net worth category indicate bargain shopping for a home in this way. Note that these millionaires and decamillionaires were responding to questions about searching for homes that they themselves would own and occupy, not just fixer-upper homes they intended to use as rental property. You may also be surprised to find that some wealthy prospective home buyers search the obituaries for early evidence that an estate sale may be forthcoming. One enterprising millionaire wife couldn't wait for owners of trophy homes to pass away. She placed the following notice in the mailboxes of residences in a lovely neighborhood. Notice: I would like to purchase a home in your neighborhood. If you have any interest in possibly selling your home in the next year, contact me immediately at the phone number below. She had a number of interesting responses within days. Guidelines from millionaire buyers. What do millionaires tell me about how they purchase homes? This set of guidelines is based on survey responses from 733 millionaires, as well as focus group and personal interviews. For most millionaires, at least part of their financial success can be attributed to careful selection of residential real estate. They report significant appreciation in the value of homes they have purchased. You don't have to be a millionaire to capitalize on their recommendations. The large majority of these millionaires are self-made affluent, and they started at economic ground zero. Their home buying processes are generally part of an overall investment plan. Planning and studying investments and investment opportunities is a regular task for about 9 in 10 millionaires. 1. Be willing to walk away from any deal on any home at any time. For every 100 millionaires who report that at least once in the process of buying a home they were unwilling to walk, there are 456 who never, ever entered into a home negotiating process without being willing to walk away. In other words, 82% of these millionaires felt they could just say no to a seller. This percentage is also correlated with net worth. Decamillionaires are the largest percentage of all millionaire groups who believe in the importance of one's willingness to walk. A self-made decamillionaire once gave me sound advice. He told me I should never even start negotiating to buy anything that I would have difficulty walking away from. That's how he conducts his own purchasing lifestyle. He went on to say that it's a bad idea to let emotions dictate purchasing. According to this decamillionaire, one should never fall in love with things, and that includes houses. 2. Don't pay the initial asking price for any home. Have you ever paid the asking price for a home? If so, it's unlikely that you are a millionaire. For every 100 millionaires who've paid the asking price, there are about 614 who never, ever paid the initial asking price. 86% of these millionaires ask for a discount, and even the other 14% didn't just roll over and blindly pay full retail. They spent considerable time studying prices, and when a true bargain presented itself, they paid the asking price. Holly and her husband Bill were in their mid-40s and fit the perfect picture of the live-below-your-means millionaire household. But they always knew the value of owning a trophy home in a trophy neighborhood. Homes of this type were constantly in short supply in their market area and often sold the first day they were listed in the newspaper. Some were never listed at all because they were sold the day the seller called a real estate agent. Agents often have a waiting list of prospective buyers for trophy homes. Holly played bridge with several homeowners who lived in the Trophy neighborhood. And during a bridge party, one of the players mentioned that her next-door neighbor was moving. The home would go on sale in a week or two. 2 hours after learning of the availability of this Trophy property, Holly was knocking on the seller's door. She immediately recognized the bargain price the seller was asking, so she and Bill put down a cash deposit on the home the next morning. The case of Holly and Bill is not pro forma for most millionaires. When they purchase homes, they generally play the game of competition. They usually select at least two homes that satisfy their needs, and then the price negotiations begin. The key is knowing the market and the value of homes and being resolved not to pay full retail. This requires some time in researching the prices of recent home sales in selected neighborhoods. Nearly 5 in 10 millionaires, 46%, report that they actually test for price sensitivity among various sellers of homes by making deeply discounted price offers. Then these prospective buyers gauge the responses from sellers. Many of the testers go a step beyond. They ask the listing agent to lower the commission rate. They hope this will in turn increase the probability that the seller might lower the asking price even more. Who would you expect to aggressively negotiate the price of a home this way? It isn't what you would expect. People who have a difficult time making ends meet. There is a highly significant positive correlation between net worth and aggressive commission or price-related negotiating. Fully 42% of all decamillionaires are aggressive commission or price negotiators. Only 29% of millionaires in the $1 million to $2 million net worth category negotiate this way. 3. Never try to purchase a home within a short span of time. Does haste make waste? In most cases, the answer is yes. Yet we can all learn from our mistakes. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Even millionaires admit to having made less than optimal home buying decisions sometime in their past, and more often than not, these decisions were made in haste. If you find yourself in a situation where you must purchase a home in a short span of time, make sure you find the best real estate agent possible. A highly skilled, top-producing agent is a walking, talking information database. He or she should be able to forecast what homes sold today will be worth next year, in 5 years, and in 10. Ask for references. Contact people who bought homes from the agent years ago and ask how well the agent predicted the home values. These people have a history of finding homes that are winners, and they can sell homes quickly even in down markets. But remember two numbers, 10 and 65. I have found in my long experience studying the affluent and the sales professionals who represent them that about 10% of the sales professionals account for more than 65% of the business generated by millionaire households. I consistently find that economically successful people patronize the most productive CPAs, attorneys, physicians, and real estate agents. Millionaires have a knack for finding great talent, and they have developed a keen sense of evaluating various suppliers. How does one go about finding a top gun of a realtor? Your corporate employer may have a database and experience with such talent. Go out and buy the Sunday edition of the newspaper, or check out the internet for real estate companies. Then call the managers of these firms and ask for the names of their top guns, and call them that. Ask about the accuracy of their forecasts about home values. Ask for and check the previous clients. Ask previous clients how well the real estate agent predicted the future. Another technique used by economically successful people involves their legal help. They patronize law firms that have multiple offices, generally well-known large to medium-sized firms. So if they are moving from New York to Atlanta or Chicago to Denver, they can ask their attorney to refer them to an associate who lives in that city, and then ask the associate for referrals to real estate agents. You don't have to be a millionaire to patronize a large or medium-sized law firm. At the very least, you can have them construct a will for you and your spouse. Often, you will not only get great professional core services, you will also have access to their information network. These law firms often have partners and associates who are real estate specialists and can point you to highly productive agents. And you should use your attorney to help you consummate the closing and advise you about pros and cons of the purchase contract. But that isn't all. There is yet another potential benefit from working closely with quality law firms. 4. Consider searching for a home that was part of a foreclosure, divorce settlement, or estate sale. Have you ever bought a home from a bank? I did. I'd like to tell you that I was hunting for a real bargain home, but I wasn't. I just saw a for sale sign on the lawn and later found out that this brand new home was a foreclosure. Yet some millionaires I have surveyed are more proactive than yours truly. 1 in 4 millionaires report searching for a bargain home that was part of a foreclosure, divorce settlement, or estate sale. In the 36 months that followed the stock market crash of 1987, fully 37% of those who purchased homes were in the searching for a foreclosure group. Many of these people are just waiting for the next market plunge. Some millionaires discovered such opportunities through their affiliation with a quality law firm. Why not ask your attorney some creative questions? Does anyone in your firm specialize in foreclosures, divorce settlements, or estate sales? If so, would it be possible that I, as your client, be referred to any possible bargain-priced homes that need to be sold? According to my surveys, attorneys are more likely than any other occupational group to indicate that they have searched for bargain homes in the distressed categories. Not all distressed homes are physically distressed, nor are they necessarily lower priced. Builders and buyers involved with luxury homes are not immune to the laws of economics and bankruptcy. There are plenty of those cowboys of speculation currently living in million-dollar homes, whose short-term income will not always be enough to cover long-term mortgage debt. There are many credit-related sales of expensive homes, even in good economic times. Consider a recent advertisement in the Wall Street Journal. Trophy Property Auction, Atlanta's 3 Finest Mansions. It seems that America's trophy property auctioneers have a different definition of trophy property than I do. To me, it means those lovely 3-, 4-, and 5-bedroom homes that are located in fine older neighborhoods. They aren't mansions, but their owners are quite wealthy. However, the 3 mansions listed may have once been owned by people who are not currently wealthy. What else can one conclude from the statement, "Bank orders these properties sold"? Could it be that someone spent more than they earned? Why else would they part with Buckhead's most palatial mansion? An opulent French Renaissance palace with grand salon. 24-carat gold fixtures. An opulent 22-room mansion. A lagoon pool with waterfalls and spa. 5. Observe the millionaire's guideline about building a custom home. Only a minority, 27% of millionaires, has ever had a home custom built for them. Most buy previously owned homes, although some have purchased new homes built speculatively by a builder or developer at or near completion. In fact, at least once in their lifetime, about 1 in 5 millionaires purchased a so-called spec house. There are various reasons why millionaires are averse to the custom route, and these are detailed later in this program. If you are insistent on having a home built for you, I tell people who ask for advice about construction ventures that building a home is like going into a business about which you know little or nothing. Not only are you going into business, often you are also going to work with a stranger. A stranger, the building contractor, will be your partner, but he is usually a limited partner. Since you are underwriting this venture, much of the economic risk will be on your shoulders. First, I advise you to exploit your patronage relationship with your accountant and your attorney. Both of these professionals and their respective colleagues have considerable knowledge about various home building contractors. They have experience with the good ones, the bad ones, and even some great ones. You want seasoned, astute professionals on your side if you're going into a venture with a builder. You want them to help you put together a long list of potential partners and then prune the list. Once you have a short list of 2 or 3 builders who qualify, then it's time to deal. But don't you be the senior negotiator. Specify certain requirements about budget, time constraints, and construction plans, and then leave it in the hands of your CPA and lawyer. These professionals have an extraordinary ability to satisfy a very wide variety of needs. Consider, for example, the role an enlightened accountant recently played in helping a wealthy client who expressed interest in having a custom home constructed. Keep in mind that the accountant, Mr. Art Gifford, is a skilled and experienced negotiator. He often negotiates the purchase of everything from businesses to automobiles. In the process of speaking with a client, a neurosurgeon, I discovered that he was about to be taken advantage of. He was about to cut a deal with a building contractor, but he had no experience in dealing with contractors. Many, many problems. The builder wanted to charge my client cost plus 15% for his fee. It's a bit stiff when you're talking about a $1.1 million home. There were some other problems, too. The builder also wanted my client to pay a 5% sales commission on the $300,000 lot where the home was to be built. The builder wanted to be the agent. He also owned the lot. Nice deal. He proposed to my client that he pay a $15,000 sales commission on the lot, plus 15% of the $1.1 million for his fee. That $15,000, plus $165,000 for the builder fee, a profit of $180,000, not including the more than $100,000 profit on the lot alone. I told the builder that the client gave me full authority to negotiate. Also reflected upon what other, competing builders were currently charging in this economy, and added that several of my clients were home builders. They would be pleased, very pleased, to build a home of this value for 10%. I told him that there should be no sales commission on the lot. Also thought that a 10% fee on the home would be more reasonable. My client, the neurosurgeon, hates to hassle, doesn't have the time. And a lot of people, especially doctors, find it a bit degrading to have to quibble over price. So I offered to negotiate on his behalf. I enjoy the negotiating process, especially when I'm representing a client. I do it all the time. The first thing I did when I spoke to the builder was cut out the 5% sales commission on the lot. So I saved my client $15,000.